You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
My favorite correspondent who sends me the best information, Jeb Card, he listens to some of these radio shows, and he listened to Banal of America. Is that how you pronounce it, Tim Banal? I never listened to it. But
no idea.
But anyway.
So when you were talking about the show, you actually hadn't heard it yet?
No, I didn't.
You were relying on witness testimony, I guess you could say?
I have a correspondent. He's a professor. And
you're listening to Banal of America Audio.
So let's segue that to the Ben Radford story, because that's sort of what set me off on it. Because you say to him, how come you never look at any of the cases that are good? And then together you guys launch into this joint investigation of a particularly compelling psychic detective case. And then it just goes completely off the rails. And I presume this was like live during a show, right? This wasn't just you guys hanging out and doing these things off, quote-unquote, off the record or off the air. This was like a show you did, and it just sounded like it went absolutely bonkers over minutia, right?
Yeah. So it was a joint investigation between this science writer, Ben Radford, who is a skeptic, you know, and again, there's the crossover with the UFO field. I mean, here's somebody who's outed themselves as a skeptic, writes for skeptical publications, goes to all the skeptical things, but he also writes for mainstream science, okay? So Discover Science, and, you know, he gets in science news every now and then. So he kind of cloaks himself in this idea of legitimate science. Anyways, a likable guy. I mean, at least he was before we had this investigation. And we spent a lot of time together, months, you know, several. The investigation took several months, and we had many, many calls together. And as you alluded to, what we decided to investigate was a psychic detective case. So everyone's seen these on TV where a psychic helps a detective. Usually, you know, it's a kidnapping, a missing person, but usually it's a murder. And that's what this was. It was a serial murder investigation in New Jersey. And the psychic was Nancy Weber. And there were these two detectives who, it's also important to note that these two detectives didn't even know each other before the case. So these detectives came together and they said, wow, you know, this woman blew us away at what she was able to tell us. And it was amazing. And as the investigation turns out, again, for political cop reasons, these guys were hot on the trail of doing it and then got, like, you know, infighting over this high profile case, this other group, you know, kind of pushed them out of the way, and they didn't do the investigation, but they stayed on it, and eventually this guy is apprehended. And when the guy is apprehended, then it was even more clear how accurate the psychic was. So this is a case where you can't say that the psychic, quote-unquote, solved the case, although that is a whole other story, which is just, talk about a mind blowing kind of thing.
That's a whole other thing. Just, you know, that just causes too many other troubles in this story. But go on.
So you have this, the case as it's resolved, what the psychic gave the police was incredibly accurate. For example, some of the information that the psychic gave the medium was to say, stumbling over my words here.
It's okay.
What the psychic gave the detectives said, hey, this guy is from the local area. He lives in the Hollow, which was a particular little area in New Jersey where he's from. He says, I smell like a gas station. You know, he's somehow associated with a gas station. His brother owned a gas station. His last name begins with a K and ends with an itch. I get a kitch that's like a Polish kind of thing. Then she says, hey, this guy was from here, but he went to Florida. He was convicted of murder. Oh, my God, they let him out. Somehow he was released from prison in Florida wrongfully, and he came back up, and this is the guy you're looking for. She does some other amazing things. Like she says, she tells him that this guy was pulled over for a traffic ticket. And you go. She goes, you have his name. It's in your files because he was pulled over for this traffic ticket. And the officer who gave him the ticket, his name is, and she gets you know, enough of the name where the guy goes, was it this? And she goes, yeah, that's got to be it.
Yeah.
So she gives him all this amazing information, right? Mm-hmm. All is corroborated. You know, Tim, I don't have a lot of experience with police detectives, in particular homicide detectives.
No?
But I don't think you can bullshit those guys very easily. You know, you got a guy who's a captain, who's
yeah.
been there for 20 years, who's done hundreds of these things. You know, you don't just pop in there like Mary Poppins and say, oh, I see a vision of this. These people are not bullshitted.
Right.
So for the testimony of these cops to say, yeah, she did all this stuff and it was amazing, was pretty convincing for me. But in my investigation with Ben Radford, we reviewed the whole thing. I interviewed both Lieutenant Hughes and Captain Moore, and I have transcripts of those interviews. I have the recordings of those interviews. They're on the Skeptical website still. Anyone can go listen to them. Ben interviewed those guys. Now, he doesn't have transcripts. He doesn't have recordings, but that's okay. Then Ben got together with me.
Stop. Hold on now. Let me stop you there. That's just a case example right there of, you know, you are extra studious and fastidious about getting the information right. And he just doesn't give a fuck. Or he has them and he won't produce them because they show that he's wrong about something.
Well, and that's kind of what I suspect.
Okay. But I'll put the words in your mouth. But that right there, it's like the standards of investigation right there. The, you know, he's lazy and you're fastidious if he doesn't have that information. You know, and this isn't 1960. You know,
right.
He interviewed him at the same time you did. He just couldn't be bothered to get the transcripts and the recordings, even though you did, even though this was like a challenge of sorts. So that's right there an indictment on this guy. But continue, please. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to say that.
No, I'm glad you did, because, Tim, that's the point. Like, and you've done enough of these investigations on your own, because, you know, when you talk to and you interview people, you know, you're drilling into them and asking tough questions. Well, so that's what I'm doing with both these detectives and then with Ben. So I get on the phone with Ben after I've done my interviews, and he says, okay, you know, I found this discrepancy. Captain Moore, he didn't say that the whoever the perpetrator was down in Florida and was released. He said that the psychic said he went to the South and then he was released. Now, first of all, why someone given this just kind of avalanche of information would kind of pick out that distinction between whether she said the South or whether she said Florida is kind of mind-blowing.
Right. That's one detail amongst, let's say, we don't know the total number of, like, actual discernible details, but let's say 50 details. If she gave 50 details
right.
about the case, it's one out of 50.
Right. And it's not even a significant one. I mean, most people would say, well, you know, the South, Florida, I mean, you know, okay. But he's like, no. You know, she said Florida, and the cops disagree with her. Well, so take out the absurdity of that. I said, well, no, that just isn't true. I have the interview. I'm looking. I'm reading the transcript right here. I paid to get these transcripts done. Captain Jim Moore said Florida. And he was insisting. He goes, no, I have it right here in my notes. You know, I'm an investigative reporter. I have it in my notes. I said, well, we'll call him up. We'll call him up right now. So we do a conference call. And, again, this is both in the book. The audio is on my website, and the transcripts are on my website. We call up Captain Jim Moore, and, man, he really lit into Ben. It was kind of fun. He goes, no, I did not tell you that. I said Florida. I always said Florida. That's what I said, you know. So, you know, Ben then backs into this position. He goes, okay. And, again, remember, this is Florida versus the South. This
right.
is what this is kind of reduced down to now, whether the psychic said Florida or whether the psychic said the South. Anyway, so he goes, okay, Lieutenant Hughes. Lieutenant Hughes is the one who told – now I'm remembering. Lieutenant Hughes is the one who told me the South.
Oh, my God. He should be embarrassed, but go on.
So we call – I go, great, we'll call him up. Another conference call. Now, this detective from the New Jersey State Police is on the phone with me. And Ben is on the phone, three-way conference call, and I go, okay, I'm going to turn over to Ben. He has some inconsistencies in your story. And this guy says, well, I think I said Florida. He says, if I use the generic term, maybe, you know, but I do remember Florida. So now this guy is totally, he said, you know, he's a Jersey cop. He said, okay, you know, maybe I said the South, but I remember Florida, you know, if I threw the South in there, whatever. Again, it's kind of a more realistic kind of thing.
Right.
So the upshot of all this, it's a long kind of hilarious story, but the really sad part is, to this day, after that interview, Ben still went and published a book, and he used this as an example of how he debunked a psychic detective case. And he still, to this day, says that the police detectives contradicted the psychic. And he even said this, which is just such a total distortion of the truth that it really does kind of hurt my stomach. He says, well, you can either believe the cops or you can believe the psychic. And, of course, the thing is, the cops are in total agreement with the psychic, have always supported Nancy Weber, have always supported her story, and Ben has just done a complete twist of the truth to suit, you know, suit
himself.
His purposes and his audience.
Suit himself, yeah. Well, you know, it's like I said, the guy should be embarrassed. I can't believe. Well, did you call him out on this afterwards? I mean, has anybody called him out in the ensuing years or whatever since this all went down? I mean, that's a pretty glaring, a galling act, really. Has anyone, what's his response to this?
You know, just, you've probably had some of these conversations too, but when the facts don't matter. You know, the facts don't matter, and he just sticks to his story.
All right.
Even though anyone can go right now to skeptico.com and listen to the whole thing, and no reasonable person will just, you know, like you kind of mentioned earlier, and I said it really was a turning point for me in Skeptico, because I realized that there just are some people out there that are just stuck, and that the evidence really isn't going to matter. Because, I mean, anyone who goes through this and listens to the, you know, we got, 5 or 6 hours on there. You listen to those 5 or 6 hours. If you listen to those 5 or 6 hours and you believe, you agree with Ben, we probably aren't going to have much of a conversation because there's nothing to talk about. You know, there's just, but there are some people that are just fundamentalists who are just afraid of any kind of change in their belief system, and, you know, they just wind up in some pretty, you've seen that, right? I mean, you've seen that in the UFO thing. It's the swamp gas thing all over.
Oh, yeah, they're just ardent skeptics, you know. They're just, but that's like I said, that's galling. I can't believe this guy would do that. And, you know, I know people who hold him up in high regard. People have recommended to have him on the show. People who are friends of me. I can't imagine how I'd ever have this guy on the show. I'd have to lead off.
Have him on the show. We'll do a debate. Have him and I on the show.
I'd have to lead off with this whole fiasco. Well, you actually hit the D word there I was going to ask you about, because as I'm reading the book, I keep, like, waiting for this, like, climactic moment on your program where there's going to be, like, a debate, because you have guests on, you know, sort of non-believers, for serious lack of a better term, but skeptics, I guess, you know, skeptics, and then you have the experts on, and then you sort of have this sort of, like, point-counterpoint. Have you ever done or thought about doing sort of a debate show where these people could actually talk to each other? You know, instead of you having to be like, well, I had Dr. X, Y, and Z on last week, and she said that, you know, all dogs, you know, have to go to the bathroom at a certain time, so they go, you know, whatever. You know, what's your response to that? And then the person has to explain it. Have you ever just had them on together to try and hash this out?
You know, I did explore that at various times over the years, but what I've found is, at least personally, I think it works better kind of single-threading it, you know, because so many of these quote-unquote debates, they just don't go – they turn into these kind of stage predictable kind of events.
Hmm.
And it also is just a nightmare, you can probably relate, but scheduling-wise, you know, it's hard to get these people, let alone, you know, getting one of them, but then getting a couple of them. So I've had better luck with doing this kind of threading where, you know, I'll talk to one person and then I'll say, okay, this person said this, how do you respond? And fitting that into kind of a broader kind of discussion. So that's just been kind of a personal style yeah. thing that's kind of worked better for me.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, I figured I'd ask, though, because, I mean, people have suggested I do a debate on the show before. You just did. But I don't know. I never really – there's a lot of, like, what you said, the logistics of it, and then also it's like you got to find the right mix and,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of I'd rather have two sort of people who I actually respect debate each other about an issue. So I agree. I don't think we'll be having Ben Radford on to debate anything. So to jump from there, I wanted to just sort of pontificate a little bit about the healing part of the book, because I thought that was interesting, because, you know, I'm a capitalist at heart, even though I barely promote my show or make any money off of it, but I do enjoy profiting from things. And healing chapter I thought was interesting. This, because to me it was like you'd think that there would be sort of like this capitalist interest in all that, in the sense where it's like, if this Bengstam method is so good, you know, why don't I go learn it and then go get a kiosk at my mall and heal tons of people, and then word by then will spread like wildfire because I've just healed like 8 people of cancer, you know, down at the mall. You know, and the next thing you know, people are learning the Bengstam method instead of going to medical school. Like, why hasn't this taken off like wildfire if it's actually so good?
You know, Tim, it's funny you should say that, because I'm totally a capitalist, and I've had that exact same thought. You know, I'm not in a position to where I have to do that, you know, but I would definitely do that. I would definitely freaking do that. You know, the story you're alluding to is, I have not done, I really only did one investigation on healing. And it was this interview I did with this Dr. William Bengstam, who is a sociologist. And I forget the name of the university. It's in, I think it's in New York, or it's in the East Coast. But Bengstam, really interesting guy, highly regarded guy. He's the past president and maybe the current president of the Society for Scientific Investigation, which is really, really an interesting group with some really qualified, top-notch people, and they put out a great journal. And so he's highly respected by not only people within the sociology community, but the broader science community as well. And he's a guy that kind of stumbled into this investigation of healing because I really like the guy, and he is the ultimate scientist, you know? So he ran into this guy who said that he was a healer, you know, just kind of, I forget what, but it was like a social thing. Like, he met the guy at the pool, you know, because he was a big swimmer and this and that. And this guy starts talking, you know, and you can imagine. The guy says, yeah, well, you know, I did this thing. He goes, really? You know, okay, let's see, you know. So he starts devising experiments for this guy, just little ad hoc experiments, because he's curious. Some guy says he can heal people. He says, okay, let's see it. Well, it turns into kind of a pretty serious research effort on the part of Bengstam, because this guy who's the healer continues to blow his mind at what he's able to do. And they wind up doing this experiment. And this experiment was done, and I may get this wrong, but again, Bengstam has published all this, so you can check me out on this. If it wasn't NYU, it was a New York University. But Bengstam had knew a guy, colleague, who was studying cancer. And he went to this guy and he said, look, I got this guy and he's blowing me away with this healing stuff. What could we devise if I wanted to do an airtight experiment with the proper controls to prove that this guy can really do his thing? What should I do? And the guy from NYU says, hey, man, I got it. It's these mice. He goes, I know this sounds horrible, but we experiment on these mice. We inject them with a certain cancer, and within 27 days, these mice die, every one of them. I mean, they're bred to all be the same, identical, cloned, and, you know, that's it. And that's how we test them. That's how you would want to test them. So he puts together this experiment, and he tests these mice. These mice in this cage are given cancer. his healer backs out at the last minute.
Yeah.
But Bengtson steps in there and does the healing procedure himself, puts his hands over the cage. He has a protocol that he goes through. And as he describes it, these mice start developing these ulcers that you can see, cancerous ulcers. And Bengtson is like, oh, my God, this is already a horrible experiment. We've given these mice cancer, and I understand that people are uncomfortable with that. I'm uncomfortable with it, but that's how we do medical research. Anyways, he's now extra uncomfortable because these mice are really looking bad. But the other guy says, hey, you're into this. You need to proceed with the experiment, and just let's see where this thing goes. A few days in, he does the healing. The ulcers burst. The cancer is gone in these mice. These mice are cured. He says, I used to say that the mice were in remission, and I was corrected and told that these mice were cured. The mice live out their natural life of 2 to 3 years. First time the NYU professor tells him that this is the first time that he is aware in medical history that these mice, after being injected with cancer, have lived this long. And this guy has done it with energy healing. So, an amazing story from, and not just a story. The guy has published his research. He's replicated his research. He's had different people do the research. He's not hiding. You can find him. You can find his interview on my website. You can find his book. You can find him.
Yeah.
This is not super secret stuff. But you would think it is because no one's heard of it. But to your point, I tell you, I got to laugh. I've thought the same thing. I thought, you know what? If the situation was different, I'd go open up a frickin' clinic, and I'd figure out some kind of value proposition. You know, hey, it's $100,000 if we cure it. It's zero if we don't. You know, come on in. You know?
Yeah, man. Hey, find me the best three mediums, and we'll open up a kiosk. I'll do it. You won't have to do anything, dude. I'll run it for you. Yeah, man, and then we'll change the world, you know.
Yeah, you know, it would do both. You know, there's no reason you couldn't make a lot of money and change the world at the same time.
Plus,
again,
you know, if you did start making a lot of money, that would change that would quickly change the perspective of the scientific and mainstream community. Then they'd be like, oh well, we got to patent this and get it out of their hands.
And you know, it's a strange world that we live in. Because I'll tell you another little, the follow-up to the Bengtson story is, I went and had a little bit of a medical dilemma myself, and I sought out, because I had always told myself, this Bengtson thing kind of blew me away, but then it was, you know, next week it was the next show, and I was on to my next thing, you know.
I hear you, man. But I get through that, yeah.
But I always kept in the back of my mind that, you know, if I got cancer, or if I ever had a serious, I would damn well do this, you know.
Mm.
And that situation did play out, not with cancer, but with this other condition I had that I described in the book. And I did find a healer that was trained at the Bengtson method, and we did do it, and it was pretty amazing. I can't say that, you know, that it was totally responsible. I'm better. I can't say it's totally because of that, because, you know, I was doing everything I could to get better, you know.
Yeah.
So I was doing dietary changes and supplements and all this other stuff because, shit, I wasn't worried about, you know, being that guinea pig. But the one thing I did want to say is, in that sense, I was. You know, like I told this healer, I said, do I have to believe in this? And she's like, well, you know, believe that. Because I don't want to have to believe in this. I'm not going to believe in this. I'm going to be that mouse in that cage like Bengtson was healing, right?
Yeah.
That mouse, they didn't have to visualize, do any visualization exercises or anything like that. They were just a mouse running around with cancer. And that's how I want to be. And so, but my point is that, you know, as these things, so Bengtson is big into, you don't have to believe in any of this stuff. It just happens. It just works. But the way that the healers take it, and they don't always take it in that way. They start mixing in with a lot of New Age and spiritual and other stuff that I'm not saying that some of that might not be true, but you know, the scientist guy, Bengston, said, well, I'm not into that. I'm just into, you know, it somehow works.
Right. Yeah. Well, I wonder, though. That just makes me wonder more, too. He's trained people on all this stuff. It just seems like it should be, you know, it should be working better, maybe. Or maybe there's not enough healers, or maybe not enough people are going.
I live out here in Southern California, and there's a ton of energy healers out here. But the other thing I think is different people have different skills. But I tell you, anyone who's listening to this who has a serious medical condition, well, you know, I would just be open to exploring it on your own, you know, and exploring Bill Bengston or exploring whatever it is. But, you know, why you would not make yourself available to the other options that are out there, in my experience, I think it'd be really, really smart to look at. That just seems clear to me. Now,
well,
the economics
and
I are saying about opening up our kiosk and stuff, you know, I don't know. I like I say, it's intriguing to me. But what I know is anyone who has a medical condition that, you know, might benefit from this, you're crazy not to be open to it because there are people who get better from energy healing. That's my experience.
Well, see, the problem is that it involves death and everything in life and stuff. So it's like people, you don't really get a second chance. You can't do a do-over. You know what I mean?
Right.
So people are unwilling to take that risk in a sense. You know, but who knows? Obviously, people should just do their own thing when it comes to this healing. I don't recommend anything because I don't want some lunatic, you know, blaming me for something. Because I don't know what I would do in that situation, to be honest with you, because I talk a good game, but if I went to the doctor and they, like, said, you have cancer tomorrow, I'd be like, well, I want the most cutting-edge treatment science can provide, you know?
Right.
So I may be an idiot like that. I don't know, you know? So don't take my word for it, folks.
I mean, and BOA is a testament to this, and I hope Skeptico is a testament to this, is that, you know, knowledge is power. And knowledge is transformational. So, you know, just opening yourself up to what's out there, sucking up the knowledge, and then you can make any damn decision you want. You know, you can go chemo, you can do whatever you want, but inform yourself first. You know, get the best information into your head, follow the data as best you can, and then make that decision. Don't let your pre-existing beliefs, you know, kind of tell you that, you know. I just had a guy on my forum the other day, and he seems like a really nice guy, but he's kind of new to the forum. And he was listening to this show that I had done with Rick Archer, this guy who has a show called Buddha at the Gas Pump that I really like. Buddha at the Gas Pump. He talks to all these people that have gone through this spiritual enlightenment, like meditation or whatever. But it's a very interesting show, all these variety of people. So at one point in the show, Rick and I are talking about UFOs, and I say, you know, hey, you know, one thing I think we got to throw in the mix here is in this extended consciousness, whether it's with psychedelics or near-death experience or mediums, over and over again, these people are encountering stuff that sounds a lot like what people in the UFO are encountering.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what to make of that. I'm not drawing any firm conclusions. I'm just saying there seems to be some connection there. So Rick and I have this conversation, and Rick says, interestingly enough, he says, hey, in the traditions that he's talking to, for people who are not familiar with it, you could kind of lump them into Buddhism. They're not all Buddhists, you know, he talks to Christian mystics, but people have had these incredible spiritual awakenings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, there's a lot of people that have had these incredible spiritual awakenings, and they've encountered, you know, these beings that start looking and talking and saying, you know, a lot of the stuff that is consistent with what abductees are reporting, or what people in the UFO community are reporting, right? So he's just saying that's part of the mix there, you know, without drawing any firm conclusions. Back to the guy on our forum, he says, man, you know, I love this show, Alex. I love what you're doing, but you guys are nuts. you know, this UFO, you're taking seriously this idea of UFOs, I got to stop listening to the show, you know, because you guys are legitimate nuts and crazy, you know.
Oh, man, what a loser. Don't stop listening. Just, yeah, it's ridiculous.
Well, but isn't that the way it is, you know, for all of us?
I bet you anything, though, he still listens. That's the thing. I bet you he's listening now.
Well, I hope he is. I hope he is because, you know, I don't know. What's it been like for how much have you changed over the years, BOA?
Oh, man. I was like a wide-eyed, hopeful believer, in a sense, when I started all this. I was kind of hoping that this was all going to break open. You know, I thought my generation was going to be the one to kind of break it open. I was, I was like in my mid-20s when I got into, really started becoming a producer of content, let's say. So, and that was after like 3 years of being interested in it in the first place, so.
What was your interest like when you first began? I'm sure you've covered this on the show, but I was kind of scouring your show trying to figure out some of this early history. I mean, I'm sure at some point you thought this UFO stuff was crazy, but then you became a believer, and then you became a kind of, I don't want to say a skeptic, but just kind of a questioning some of the party line in terms of UFO. But what about way back? I mean,
I guess not. Like when I first started, I was, you know, first I never gave it any thought. Then I came to the conclusion that there was something to this UFO mystery. Then I sort of launched the show. And at the time, the wide-eyed believer part was that they were close to figuring it out and everything.
Right.
And then as time went on, I came to the realization that they're no closer to figuring it out than they were decades ago.
Right.
And then it's all a big show. The UFO
right.
research field is a big show.
Right.
And that's kind of the conclusion I came to. There's still a UFO mystery, but there's a whole different world that's the UFO research community that almost has nothing to do with the actual UFO mystery. It just promulgates the UFO
right.
mystery. So, you know, have me on Skeptico. I'll be happy to talk about all this stuff, you know. Break from tradition and have a have a crazy ass on, and I'll be happy to delve into all this. But yeah, it's a scientific and sociological problem wrapped up in and of itself. So, you know, and I still believe there's something to the UFO phenomenon, but I'm not any closer to knowing what it is than when I did BOA episode 1. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've just become more disillusioned and but also more driven to sort of figure out the right questions to ask, which is where I sort of come down on American ufology, where it's like they're not really asking the right questions, they're not introducing the right ideas or the right areas to explore. Some people are, but they're few and far between. The rest seem to be want to rehash old cases, you know, or demand that the government tell us what's going on without showing their work, as I say.
And how much of that is, as you were alluding to before, just kind of the kind of basic social kind of stuff, the way that we all kind of are? And what percent of it do you think is somehow some co-opting of the process by people who have a different agenda?
Oh, like a conspiracy?
Yeah.
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know. It's kind of like it's really more just sociological. I mean, they can't, the folks who are quote unquote trying to figure it out can't figure it out. The field, without knowing it, realized that it couldn't figure it out a long time ago, and now it's kind of like chasing its tail to try it, because it has to keep feeding the machine of ufology. So it's
right.
like, let's take the fifth look at Rendlesham. It's like, no, let's
right.
fucking not, because, you know, it's not working. But I think, like, to tie this into what to your stuff, it's you know, I have here in the notes, I think it's sort of like the boiled frog aspect, because this is part here at the end about changing science. When is science going to change? Is science at a tipping point? Someone else pointed out earlier in the book, or in the chat room here, Jim Latica said, you know, that we talk about science being afraid of death. Well, maybe science is afraid of death because death is the great equalizer of scientific ideas. And as the as these people whose minds are closed to the strange and unusual, as they die off, more younger people will come along and maybe be more open to it. I've advocated that that's a generational thing, that maybe the UFO phenomenon will benefit from, maybe the whole realm of the paranormal will benefit from these people who have been conditioned since, you know, these baby boomers, even Gen Xers and stuff, who have been conditioned throughout their lives that this is all bullshit. As they die off and these millennials and whatnot come along, they're going to be the ones who are like, no, man, there's more to it, you know. And you and me, Alex, you know, we're screwed because, you know, I'm 35. By the time the frog boils, I'm going to be barely hobbling around. And I hate to say it, man, but I don't know if you're even going to be here. So,
well,
that's kind
you know,
of the
that,
way
that's another that's an area where I'm kind of skeptical, like you are too. You know, because whenever I hear that, and there's the crossover with the UFO community, you know, it's like science at the tipping point is like the tagline for my show,
mm-hmm.
and that's really kind of come back to bite me in the ass because I don't believe science is at any freaking tipping point. It ain't tipping nowhere, and the status quo has not begun to fight, and you know. So we went through a scientific revolution back in the early 1900s where there was spiritualism, there was all this interest in consciousness and, you know, the leading scientists in the world were very much more open than they are now. So, you know, this myth of this straight line of progress, I think, is kind of, you know, that and I that's one thing I'm skeptical of in the UFO community, and because I have investigated a little bit and have some interviews on there. You know, I interviewed Stan Friedman, but I also interviewed David Jacobs, you know, who really a lot of people hate, you know, but I interviewed him and I interviewed
associated with his work nowadays, but we won't delve into that right now. The listeners of this show know all about it, so go on.
Well, we could, because that's what I got right in the middle of that one. And I knew the problems with Jacob's work and some of the accusations. But I kind of pitted him against Mary Rodwell, who is – do you know Mary Rodwell in Australia?
Are you thinking Emma Woods, or is that a different person?
No. So Mary Rodwell also does regression therapy with people who believe they've had an abductee experience. And I also interviewed a Dr. Janet Colley, who is a licensed psychiatrist and is part of the, you know, the whole John Mack thing, right?
Yes.
So it was John Mack and then John Mack versus kind of David Jacobs, and then John Mack died. And then, you know, some people have followed in the John Mack footsteps. And I'd say Dr. Janet Colley definitely falls into that camp. And Mary Rodwell kind of does too. So, you know, my point in interviewing Jacobs and Rodwell was, you know, David Jacobs, no matter what you think of his techniques and part of the problems with, you know, hypnotic regression, and we could get into that. You know, we've got a few minutes left. It might be an interesting topic to talk about because – so here's my methodology, Jim. I mean, it's fun talking to you, you know, because we do share so many – of the same experiences that other people won't be able to really totally relate to this. But
yeah.
Doing these shows, preparing for these shows, doing the interviews, doing the research, you know, it's exciting, man. And you get jazzed up before, and like when we were talking, you were saying, hey, you read the book, and then you're like, I want to talk to him right now.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to do that all the time. I'm like, no, I'm not looking at that stuff because, you know, if I'm interviewing, I just interviewed Michael Shermer a couple weeks ago, the famous skeptic, you know. But I had to hold off until just a few days before to really dig into his stuff, or I knew it was just driving me crazy, you know.
Yeah,
if I did
yeah.
it like a week before, I'd be like, so I think you and I going through that experience, you can kind of relate to some of this, but my starting point with the David Jacobs and the abduction research that is highly controversial because it uses hypnotic regression was to start with hypnosis. And say, okay, all these people are up in arms about hypnotic regression and the information you get is not reliable and all this. Like, okay, well, is hypnosis reliable? Does hypnosis even work? And it's like, so I interviewed this guy in Montreal, this practicing hypnotherapist, really nice guy. He's got some really impressive YouTube videos. That's kind of how I found him. But he's a clinical hypnotherapist. You know, you want to quit smoking or you want to lose weight or, you know, you're going to the doctor and you're afraid of going into the doctor, you know, you'd go see this guy. Well, the first thing, when you look into that research, the solid science, is that hypnosis is rock solid. I mean, it's used in hospitals all over the world, and it works, you know. I mean, it works even in this, like we started out this whole show a couple hours ago talking about consciousness. And we said, hey, near-death experience blows the doors off of consciousness. Well, frickin' hypnosis blows the doors off of mind equals brain consciousness idiocy that we have. Like at Harvard, they did this experiment with hypnosis. This is a little bit. I don't know if we'll ever get back to the Mary Rodwell story. We can save it for another time.
It's all right. It's all right. We can go longer after the live show says goodnight. So if you're comfortable going a little bit more, we can go a little bit more because I only have a few more notes anyway.
Great. That'd be great.
All right.
So I got to tell you this research because it's really fascinating. They hypnotized these people, and they told them that they were colorblind. Okay. So when you're colorblind, little cones inside your eyes don't work. They work differently, right? And I don't even know the details of that, but I know that much. So then they did an fMRI. You know, they did brain imaging on these people. And they found that, in fact, once they were hypnotized, even though they were able to see color, once they were hypnotically suggested, given that suggestion that they were colorblind, their actual physical eye worked differently as if they really were colorblind, okay?
Yeah.
So they had the ability to do that. Now, that doesn't sound that astounding. They'll go, oh, yeah, well, that doesn't mean shit. Well, actually, it does mean shit. It means a lot of shit. It means that your consciousness, that thought that was suggested, was able to change something physical. That is not mind equals brain. That is something different, something else. That little voice inside your head, which is supposed to be an illusion, is not an illusion. It changed the way that your brain works. And there's some other case studies we could give you that are even more dramatic, and we could talk about those later.
Yeah.
But so even hypnosis. And that's more controversial. That's why we talk about near-death experience, because near-death experience, it's in your face. You just can't get past the fact that the guy's brain wasn't there and he had this unbelievable experience that brains aren't supposed to do. But even something as simple as hypnosis. But that was my starting point to say hypnosis actually works. And then if you look for hypnosis and memory recovery, it works. It's been proven to work by the best methods that we have. People are able to remember things that they can't otherwise remember, and those things are later substantiated in the studies they've done as being accurate. So that is really the launching point. So when it kind of pisses me off when people say, you know, I'm not a David Jacobs supporter. I'm more of a Mary Rodwell supporter. I'm more of a Janet Colley supporter, a John Mack supporter. But that's like picking horses that are at least in the same race.
Yeah.
When people say hypnotic regression should not be trusted, it's not reliable, I say bullshit. The medical evidence suggests otherwise. The medical evidence suggests that hypnosis does allow people to remember stuff that they weren't able to remember. That's a medical fact. Now, whether it was administered properly, whether it was done, whether the best control conditions, whether the information they got was accurate, all those things are open for debate.
Right.
But you can't throw out the whole frickin' thing just because you got this idea now that hypnotic regression is kind of this blanket false thing that's it doesn't work like that, and the best medical evidence suggests the exact opposite of that.
I see what you're saying. I agree with you there. We shouldn't entirely dismiss the technique necessarily, the instrument by which it's used, but it's fair to question the information we get.
It just kind of puts you in a different position, you know.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure even how we got off on that tangent. But it's all good. Well, for the live audience, we'll sort of say goodbye to the live audience in about a couple minutes here. So let's just talk a little bit about, you know, what's next for you. What do you have coming up at Skeptico? Folks can find out more about that at skeptico.com, of course, with a K, Skeptico with a K. But, you know, what's cooking with Skeptico? You just got this book out. What's been the reaction, first of all, to the book, and what do you have coming up?
The reaction's been great, and it's been another learning experience. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, I wrote the book partially because I wanted to reach out and I wanted to talk to more people than just my community. I love my community, but I love, you know, we never would have made this connection, you and I, if I didn't have this book, probably. So that's, the book is working wonders in that way, because I think there's a lot of, you know, I think the UFO enigma, if you will, is critical to the stuff that I'm looking at in some way that I don't understand. So I want to understand it better, and I want to connect with people like you and find out more about that. And I think it's also, there's this spiritual angle, like I told you, like my buddy Boot at the gas pump. I think that plays into it. I think the parapsych, so I think a lot of these things fit together, and that's what I hope to do with the book and going forward and kind of stitching together some of these communities. The other thing, you know, the book has led to is I do kind of like mixing it up, you know, so I have a whole round of interviews coming up with some pretty prominent atheists and skeptics. Michael Shermer, I mentioned, Lawrence Krauss, you know, who's it just did this big movie with Richard Dawkins, The Unbelievers, hardcore atheists. I like talking to those guys, you know, and we go at it pretty hard, but it's a fun dialogue, and there isn't enough of that out there, you know. There's so much stuff on the internet, and there's so many podcasts, but I don't know, there's not enough kind of, I don't know, more, you know, edgy confrontational stuff, and I don't seek that out, but I don't shy away from it, so I kind of like to offer that up. So that's what's coming up.
Right, right. Well, I do like how it seems like, just based on reading the book and the transcripts from the show, it just seemed like your confrontational style at least comes from a good place, you know? You're not just bringing people on to bash them or laugh at them, you know, because that's sort of the other side of it. That's the other part of the mainstream media. They have some of these paranormal people on just to laugh at them, but it's like, you know, even if you confront people, it's coming from an honest place where you're like, well, you know, what about this research here? What's your response to that? I mean, I don't really see that as necessarily bad confrontational. You know, you're not like, hey, you're not on there like, hey, you're a fraud and you're a liar. You know, as I like to say on iShow, you know, I just hand them a rope. You know.
No, yeah, totally. And you know, there isn't a guest I've had on the show that I wouldn't invite back, and you know, they don't always accept. But I like the dialogue, and I usually find a plenty of points of agreement with everyone I talk to, and I have no in disrespecting anyone or putting people down. And science is a hard game to play, and there, I have a certain amount of respect just for these people doing it. But the same with the UFO community, you know. I mean, you got to push. You can't just be a marshmallow too and just let people, you know, just say these things unchallenged. You know, there's that's what we're all interested in, is these kind of points of conflict. I think that's where the questions are still out there.
Exactly, exactly. Well, something we could explore a little bit after the live show ends, but, you know, I thought something that Tim Freak, is that how you pronounce it, or Freaky? Freak, all right. The philosopher, consciousness explorer, you describe in the book, he sort of makes some points about reductionism and the idea of science being being reductionist and sort of always centering around the it's just thing, or if they're always there are ways to just be like, it's, well, like I just did, it's just this, it's just that, you know, why are the birds singing, it's just because that's the way they mark their territory or whatever, you know. It's very annoying. So let's talk about that after we say goodnight to the live listeners, because that'll be the tease for the live listeners to grab the MP3. Big thanks to Jim Leidica in the chat room. He was a big player in there tonight and made some really good points, I think, about the conversation as it was unfolding. You can find out more from Alex at skeptico.com. That's Skeptico with a K. Tons of shows on there, and I presume all this stuff is free, right, man?
Just like you, Tim. All free, no sponsors, no subscriptions.
Exactly. No subscriptions, no network, no rules, and no comparisons, I guess, in a lot of ways. But in some ways, we are very comparable programs. That's what I liked about your book. That's what I like about your show. It really comes off as one man's exploration into the questions that vex him, and that's really the same way Banal of America is. So I'm actually going to really try and dig into the Skeptical Archive and check it out. And, of course, the book is called Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. It's from Anomalous Books. Anomalous Books is a fantastic publishing house. They put out some tremendous stuff and have actually supplied BOA Audio with tons of great guests over the years. So head on over to Anomalous Books and pick up Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. Thanks again to the live listeners. Alex, stay put. We're going to bid them farewell in a moment, and then we'll continue the conversation.
Okay, Tim.
All right. So back to the point that I was making as the British lady started talking. You know, I thought Tim Freak's points, really, too. He talks about mystery, the mystery of, you know, all the unknowns, I guess you could say, and you talk a lot about the question of why are we here, and my personal life philosophy is that the answer to why are we here is actually like really meta. It is to ask the question of why we are here. It's to turn itself on itself. Mm-hmm. That's really what drives my whole life. You know, people ask me why I do this. It's like, you know, because I believe at the end of the day, the answer to the question of why are we here is to ask that question. So if you're not, you know, doing that in your life, then you're missing the whole point of life. That's, you know, I may be wrong about that. Maybe other people.
No, man, I think that's incredibly a profound and has a real deep connection with, you know, I was referring to before, the Skeptico. You know, it's funny. I've never been a big synchronicity guy, but I've been much more open to them lately. And I've had a couple lately that have just kind of blown me away. But the whole frickin' Skeptico show is a synchronicity. You know, I name it Skeptico. And I wasn't even sure why. I can't even tell you exactly why. You know, I'd done a little bit of research, and I found this, you know, ancient Greek philosopher, Skeptikos. And I go, oh, there, Skeptico, looked it up. You know, oh, okay, that's available, I'll take it. Years later, I find, think about this with relation to what you just said, which I think is really so cool. These ancient Greek philosophers, they would conclude nothing. Their discipline was to only question, 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 never come to any firm conclusion. Isn't that the essence of what you just said, you know, to say, what is the purpose of life? Well, the purpose of life is to ask the question, what is the purpose of life? And to keep asking the freaking questions.
Right.
So I think that's amazing. I think that's really deep.
And it goes to, that sort of segues in his section there, you know, to the reductionist aspect of science.
Right.
And it's like, you know, I've often complained to the skeptics because they mince words and they argue semantics and stuff, but it is a semantical argument in a sense where it's like science seems to be focused more on explaining all costs as opposed to, you know, asking the question of why, you know, or trying to figure things out. It's like there's a difference between trying to have an explanation and trying to actually figure it out.
Well, you know, you mentioned Tim Freak, and I think he's really, he's got some beautiful poetic things to say, and he's a top-notch philosopher, but he's just a great storyteller, too. Hmm. And I love that it's just thing, you know. It's like, you go, oh, man, it's fucking a beautiful spring day, and the birds are singing, and the scientist says, well, that's just, like you said, it's just them marking their territory and they're looking for a mate. Well, it might be that, but it's not just that. You know, it's this beautiful thing. Or I looked into my daughter's eyes, you know, the first time I laid eyes on her, and I felt this incredible emotional connection. It was just amazing. Well, that's just the neurological firing of your brain and the chemical. Well, maybe that's part, but it's not just that, Mother. It's more than that, you know? I mean, and science has battered so many people into thinking that to even entertain thoughts that it's more than that makes you somehow lesser, makes you kind of less smart, makes you less, you know, scientific and less intellectual. And it's just bullshit. They've just bullshitted themselves and twisted themselves into knots with this ridiculous, absurd shit that you are a biological robot in a meaningless universe. And as we've talked about for the last 2 hours, all that shit's been falsified. It's just true.
But we're stuck in this world. We're stuck in this paradigm. It's really very frustrating, you know. And I've tried to work with the skeptics, but I just find them to be too reductionist. That's what really made it stick out to me when I read the Tim Freak section in the book. It was like, it's exactly what it is. They're just trying to explain stuff without really trying to question it. And there is a distinction there. And it's very frustrating because, you know, it goes back to what you said. It's like, why don't they just look? If you're really passionate about disproving UFOs, disprove the best cases. There's no if, ands, or buts about it.
You know what I found, and it's kind of taken me a long time to come to this conclusion because it was, it's just too hilarious to even believe. But the skeptics are really just like the fundamentalist religious people that they rail against. They're just like them. They're the mirror image of them. And, you know, it's like if you've ever talked to, and I don't want to offend anyone, but then at the same time, I don't really care if I offend anyone. Mm-hmm. If you've ever talked to someone who's very strictly religious, like Christian apologists, you know, it's the same way. They're working backwards from where they have to get at the end of the day, which is their version of their scripture and their holy books and how their whole thing works out. And you can talk to them till you're blue in the face, but eventually they're going to come back to their end conclusion because they're working the opposite the way that science is supposed to work, which is from the bottom up. They're working from the conclusion, and then they're working backwards, and they're only looking for some kind of magical mystery way to get back to that conclusion that they can hold on to their beliefs. And that's, I think, the game that's being played by the skeptics, and whether they know that and whether they're being driven by it by their own fear or whether someone is kind of orchestrated partially, you know, they're where they've left the little breadcrumbs for them to follow, I don't know. But that sure seems to me like the game that's being played.
Right, and the system rewards them. I mean, look at Bill Nye. He's like a celebrity, you know. He's really a hardcore debunker in a lot of ways. Straight up, not in a lot of ways. He's a straight up hardcore debunker. So, but he's rewarded, you know. I saw him on Real Time with Bill Maher this week, and I was like, this is ridiculous. What could this guy possibly have to add to the conversation? And he had nothing to add to the conversation. It was laughable. But
That's where your wrestling analogy really, really, you know, just kind of stares you in the face. I mean, that's just pro wrestling. I mean, that guy doesn't have any contribution to make.
Right, right. And it's just really disappointing. It's very frustrating. You know, it's been a difficult road to hoe. I'm sure it's the same for you. How do you grapple with that frustration? You know, I mean, when did you first start doing this show? Like in 2007?
Yeah, 2006, 2006, 2007.
Yeah, so we're talking like 8 or 9 years. I mean, there's a frustration level I'm sure that you've reached at certain points. I know I have, where it's, you know, mostly it's when during that exciting time that you mentioned where you're doing the research and you're reading someone's book and you're sort of throwing your hands up like, why? I don't want to live in this world, man. That's kind of the reaction I have when I read this stuff, because it's like, I don't want to live in this world where this research is being completely ignored or marginalized, you know, or this information is not available to fucking everybody. And, you know, it's very frustrating, you know. And then you get them on the show, and I just try to hammer, for me personally, I just try to hammer the point that people need to know this stuff. But, I mean, how do you grapple with keeping this going in the face of a scientific world that continues to keep the doors shut to all the strange and unusual stuff?
Well, that's another really deep question, and I don't talk a lot about this part of this thing for me, but, you know, for me, Skeptico has really kind of taken me in some other directions, too, and the other directions it's taken me is, you know, if you deal with, let's say, the near-death experience, yeah, it kind of throws the consciousness thing and it falsifies the scientific paradigm that we're in and all the rest of that. But buddy, you and I know that it does something else too. It kind of takes you into this other realm of, shit, you mean I'm really not gonna die? And then you go look at the reincarnation research. There's some very good reincarnation research. Again, if people are put off by the idea of reincarnation research and they want to go, oh, phooey, you know, woo-woo and all this, you know, again, and like I was saying about there's a natural history. Well, there's millions, scratch that, billions of people who believe in reincarnation. But there's thousands and thousands and probably millions of people who have direct experience with feeling like they have reincarnation. So here's what happens. There's these guys at the University of Virginia. It started with this guy named Ian Stevenson, very highly acclaimed psychologist, psychiatrist, and his work has been followed up by Jim Tucker. Again, University of Virginia, top-notch university. And I just interviewed him. Interviews up there on Skeptico. Anyone can go listen to it. But Tim, here's the deal. You got kids, typically between 2 and 4 years old, who will spontaneously start recounting past lives.
Yeah.
They'll go, I used to be this. So this stuff comes up. So this is the phenomena. Like, you can ignore that if you want, but why would you? So then you go and you scientifically investigate that, which they do. You know, we have ways of investigating whether, you know, people's stories line up and, you know, all of it. So that's what they've done, you know, and people have looked at that research. That research is solid, and no one has been able to find any alternative explanations for that research that stand up. It's like the near-death experience thing as well.
Right.
So, but man, when you put that together, you know, you put together this near-death experience, you put together this reincarnation stuff, and you say, hey, if I'm thinking that this world is all there is, I'm just shutting myself down to some larger reality. And I can't tell you what that larger reality is and all this, but it does kind of soften the blow of all the shenanigans that go on and the hopelessness that goes on, you know, that you face and that I face. And, you know, maybe this stuff doesn't matter so much. Maybe it really is about what you just said a few minutes ago. Maybe it really is about the quest. For knowledge, it's about asking those questions. It's about doing your best to, you know, share what you find with other people and letting that journey change you. Maybe that's all you're supposed to do. You know, you're not supposed to reach some finish line. And I guess I'm saying you, what I really mean, that's my conclusion, you know. So it doesn't necessarily matter to me how many people listen to the show, how many people read the book. I just trust that if I'm doing my thing the right way, it's all going to work out the way it's supposed to.
Profound thoughts, man. That's kind of the way I feel too. I'm not a big, I'm not out there throwing my name out there and trying to get my show all over the place. And, you know, I kind of think of our show as kind of like an acquired taste, or you have to be in the know to know about it, you know?
And yeah. Yeah.
I'm not
interested
in those who aren't in the know. So,
your persistence and your keeping at this, I think is so important, because I think you bring a history with you to every show that you do that would be lost. And, you know, who the hell's going to do it, Tim? Who's going to do it, and who's going to continue to do it? You know, I mean, people are going to come in, they're going to get all jacked up, and they're going to dabble in it for a year or 2 years. But who's going to stick it out and be in it for the long haul? I mean, it's just a unique perspective, I think.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I was looking forward to and enjoyed talking to you. You know, it's people who have done this for this long are kind of few and far between. I mean, I've seen plenty of shows pop up, and like you said, you know, they're people get jazzed about it, and they like doing it, and then after a couple of years, they kind of find something else to do, you know. You
have, hey, Larry King, huh? That's our model, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Charlie Rose and Larry King.
Still out there doing it.
Yeah, exactly. All right, man. So I'm trying to think. There's nothing else really. There was one big thing, but let's leave that for the book. Folks should check out the part in the book about the Darwin conspiracy, because I feel like if we get into that, it's going to take another like 20 minutes, and it'll give away a big part of the book that's pretty mind-bending stuff that I was blown away by. And like I said, reading your book, it was like, I got to get this Darwin conspiracy guy on the show. But it's all really delved into there in the book. So, folks, look for that part of the book and really dig into it, folks. I really enjoyed it quite a bit. Like I said, it was a combination sort of your journey, and also I really like how you challenge these folks. You know, it's funny. I had Stan Friedman on. Obviously, I have him on every year for the holiday special. I think it was this year that it came up where it was just like, you know, why do you even bother answering these people that just keep throwing these ridiculous arguments your way after all these years? And he's like, if I don't do it, nobody else will. And it's like,
yep.
I'm glad that what you're doing is challenging these people. And as I said, I was amazed that you get some of this stuff on the record, like with Blackmore and Watt saying these ridiculous things and the way Ben Radford handled his whole thing. It's like, you know, it's just amazing to me. And, you know, we probably railed on the science and skeptical community enough, but I got real issues with those realms.
Well, hey, it was super great connecting, and, you know, we'll definitely have to stay in touch, and, you know, let me know if you ever want to come on Skeptico and talk about something. We'll make that happen.
Yeah, dude, I'd be more than happy to come on your program anytime. I think it would be a unique and interesting perspective for your listeners to hear from somebody who's been in the trenches. You know, I've been a few trenches over from you, but we've been in the trenches together for a long time, sort of dealing with all this as it unfolds. And like I said, I really enjoyed the conversation. I have a feeling it's just the first of many, Alex. So, folks, check out skeptico.com. That's where you can find out more from Alex. And the book is Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. And that's available from Anomalous Books, and you can get it all over the place as well. Thank you, Alex, once again, and let's keep in touch, my friend.
We will, Tim.
All right.
It was awesome. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you. There you go, folks. That was Alex Tsakiris talking about why science is wrong about almost everything. And, of course, as we've been talking about here on the show, he is the producer and host of the popular podcast Skeptico, which you can find out more at skeptico.com. If you're just discovering Banal of America, maybe you're a Skeptico listener who wanted to hear Alex's appearance on the program, welcome to the party. This is Banal of America. Check out the website, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. There you can find over 200 episodes, I think it's up to 230-something now, conversations with experts in all sorts of fields, and, of course, absolutely free. You can find that all at banalofamerica.com. We're also on Facebook. Just punch in Banal of America, and that will bring up our page on Facebook, where we try to post the latest info on who's coming up on the show next time and all that good stuff. Let me see what else I have to plug here. Of course, as I said, the show is absolutely free at Banal of America. The archive is free. All that stuff is free. We do that via the donations from BOA Audio listeners. Believe me, this live stuff is not cheap. Blog Talk charges an arm and a leg monthly for me to do these live programs, so any donations people can make would be hugely appreciated. You can do that in two ways. You can head on over to PayPal and make a donation. There's the button right at BOA. Or you can make a donation to our P.O. box, and the address is also right at BOA. That's what we call it, Banal of America. Let me see. I don't know what I could really plug here for the next edition of the program. I know we'll have a show next week, probably on Thursday, March 5th. I can't tell you anything about it because I haven't given it much thought beyond the fact that it'll be next Thursday. But I've got two really fantastic episodes that we taped in January and February that I want to unleash on folks soon. So maybe I'll sit down and edit one of those and get that out to folks next Thursday. But I've also got a couple of folks who I want to have on the live show soon. So if I can shoot out some emails and make it happen tomorrow, maybe we'll do a live show next Thursday. But either way, we are definitely going to have a program next Thursday. And I'll have all the information on that probably by Monday or Tuesday. I'll make a decision on what we're going to do. What else? Somebody wrote on Facebook that they missed the listener feedback, and I didn't really actually prepare anything this time, but in the future, maybe we'll do some listener feedback here at the end of the program when we do the live shows. Since I'm already sort of in the zone of making the program, I'll read some listener emails. We got a few really interesting ones, actually, and really wish I had prepared for that, because we've gotten some interesting emails lately from a whole bunch of folks, and on the next live edition, we'll rekindle BOA Audio listener feedback and try and read some emails. I'm going to have to put a sticky note somewhere here to actually do that, but I'll cultivate some emails here from the mailbag, because we've got a ton of them, and respond to those here on the live program. I said I want to talk about the trip to Georgia, but I really hate rambling and talking on my own, so I'm not going to say too much about it, except that I didn't go on a ghost hunt. Circumstances surrounding the visit really just did not allow for me to walk around in the evening in downtown Savannah looking at haunted houses and stuff. I did take a really fascinating trolley tour and learned about the history of Savannah and really enjoyed the visit quite a bit. It was exactly what I needed because I haven't had a real vacation in years. So it was a moment to step away from all of my various jobs and BOA and just relax, which was awesome. And it was something I really had to do and enjoyed quite a bit. Really, really, really enjoyed it and needed it in a lot of ways. So I feel more refreshed than I have in years and almost disoriented because I haven't had a vacation like that in a long, long time. So when you come home from something like that, everything is strange. And to case in point, this is a story, this is a good parade story, but since I'm really kind of on my own here, I will share this tale from when I returned from Georgia. You know, the big thing when you go on vacation is you want to get home and sleep in your own bed. That's the old adage about vacations. So I get home, I'm relaxing, watch some TV, get into bed that night, my first night home from vacation. All of a sudden I hear this sound. Let me see if I can recreate it using this lighter. Here's the sound. Sounds like that. Really kind of creepy. And I did, even though I didn't go on a ghost tour, I did actually visit a historically haunted pub in Savannah that Jason Offit recommended. It's called the Moon River Brewery. And it's a very fantastic restaurant with awesome, awesome food. I absolutely loved it. So thanks to Jason Offit for recommending that one, because it was one of the highlights of my trip. And it is reputedly haunted. And the cool part about it is they let you go downstairs into the completely, really untouched basement from when it was the original post office of Savannah or something like that. Then you get to go up to the attic and look around up there, and it's really, really creepy and unsettling. And I didn't see any ghosts or have any ghostly experiences, but that was the day before I left and came home. Flash forward, I'm lying in bed, I'm home from vacation, I'm hearing this sound like that. Oh, God, what is that? You know, and I'm saying to myself, well, here in Boston, it's really cold outside. I left the heat at a reasonable level. I haven't been around to make any noise. Maybe I've got a mouse. You know, I probably have a mouse here in my place. So I get up, turn on the light, have a cigarette, kind of wait it out a little bit, see what's going to happen. All of a sudden, I start hearing it again. And now I'm looking for it, looking around the room. I'm looking in the corners. I'm looking all along the baseboards because, you know, that's where a mouse is going to hide. Seeing if I can find any feces from the mouse and see if I can find any evidence that there's a mouse lurking around. Then it gets worse because then I start hearing this scratching sound. And now I'm getting very unsettled. And part of me was thinking to myself, oh, Jesus, I hope I didn't bring something back with me from Savannah, from this haunted brewery, because that's the last thing I need is some kind of ghost or poltergeist in my life. And eventually, I'm following the scratching, and I'm standing near my TV, and I look up, and there's something in the ceiling that's scratching and dropping something like this. And scratching and gnawing at wood. And it was very, very, very unsettling. And that was 2 days ago. So I have only heard it sporadically in the ensuing 2 days. I'm hoping that when I go to bed tonight, it will be gone. I heard it briefly last night at about 2 in the morning, but I was so busy doing work for tonight's program that I kind of ignored it, and it eventually went away. But I'm pretty sure it's just a straight-up animal. But the last thing I want is for it to be anything of the raccoon, possum, or rat variety. Any of those things, I really would rather it not be. So I'm hoping that it's a chipmunk or a squirrel that somehow found its way into the chimney and is mixed up in the house somehow. But very, very weird. Very weird way to return from the trip. So there's your listener feedback. There's a story from Binal that is one of the weird ones. And we'll be back on March 5th with an all-new edition of BOA Audio. If it's live, we'll have some listener feedback. If it's not, it's going to be one of these fantastic taped programs that we've been sitting on for a while. They are fantastic, folks. Trust me, I keep saying that, but they are really, really awesome stuff. And I cannot wait to unleash them on the BOA Audio listeners. And for more on the Georgia trip, I'll post some pictures on Facebook. So I'll plug in my phone and upload those soon so folks can see some of the stuff I'm talking about and some of the historic buildings and some of the weird things that I saw. For people who are asking about the weather, the snow here is insane. I'm actually working on a absolutely mind-bending, breathtaking fire pit that I should unleash Monday or Tuesday. It is awesome. I've been working on it all winter, working with all the snow. It's like this little snow room with about 6-foot-high walls and a fire pit in the middle. But we haven't christened the fire pit yet. We haven't fired it up. But once we do, I'll get some pictures of that and post those on Facebook as well. And down in Georgia, unfortunately, the first 3 days were cold as hell, just like up here, but not as bitter, not as windy. But the final 3 days were fantastic. 60 degrees, 70 degrees, almost 80 on Sunday, and then 60 degrees again with rain on Monday, and not a flake of snow in sight, which was really strange not to see any snow and then to come back here and just be completely surrounded by it. But I enjoyed the vacation quite a bit. Thanks to all the folks on Facebook who were wishing me bon voyage. Happy to be back. Loved the conversation tonight. Thought it was fantastic. I got to stop saying fantastic. I keep saying it here. I'm rambling. I've reached the point of ramblage, folks. So it's time to close the book on this edition of the program. Thank you to all you folks out there, the listeners who are new to the show. As I said, maybe you came from Skeptico and you're wondering just who the hell is this Binal guy. As noted, welcome to the party, folks. Dig into the archive. You're going to have your mind blown by this stuff that we've been producing over the last 9 years. And, of course, to the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the people who have been ride or die since the very beginning, thank you for your enduring support of BOA Audio. Season 9 has just begun, but I'm already feeling very, very excited about where this journey is going to take us this season. And as always, thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. And on that note, thank you all for listening. Until next time, this is Tim Binal signing off.